angry. I can feel it like storm waves lashing my shores. But I must know what she wrote. You have to read these books to me, from start to finish.
No. One word. For one word, I could keep my voice level and calm. His shoulders rose and fell with the strength of the breath he took. Did he struggle for control as I did? His voice was taut as a hangman's rope.
I could have hidden this from you. I could have had Spark steal the books and read them to me here in stealth. I didn't.
I unclenched my fists and my throat. That you didn't wrong me in that way makes this no less of an affront. He took his gloved hand from the bag. He put both his hands, palms up, on his knees. I had to lean closer to hear his whisper.
If you think these the random writings of a small child, your anger is justified. But you cannot believe that. These are the writings of a white prophet.
He dropped his voice even lower.
These are the writings of your daughter, Fitz, your little bee, and mine.
If he had struck me in the belly with a stave's end, the impact could not have been worse. Bee was my little girl. It came out a wolf's growl. I don't want to share her. Honesty can be like a boil that bursts at the most unfortunate time. Had I known the source of my anger before I spoke it aloud?
I know you don't, but you must.
He set his hand lightly on the pack.
This is all that she could leave for us, other than one glorious instant of holding her and watching her promise explode all around me like a geyser of light into a dark night. It is all of her that I will ever know. Please, Fitz. Please, give me that much of her.
I was silent. I could not. There was too much in those books. In her journal, there was too little mention of me from the days when she had held herself apart. Too much of a small girl fighting alone the ugly, childish battles with the other Withywood's children. Too many entries that made me feel cowardly and ashamed of what a blind father I had been. Her account of her clash with Lant, and how I had promised her afterward that I would always take her part, showed how I had failed in that regard. How could I read those pages aloud to the fool? How could I bear my shame? He knew I could not share those writings, even before he had asked me. He knew me that well. He knew that there were some things I could not yield. Why did he even dare to ask? With both hands, he lifted the pack to cradle it to his breast. The tears started in his golden eyes and traced the scars on his face as they ran down his cheeks. He held out the pack, surrendering to me. I felt like a thwarted child whose parent gives in to his tantrum. I took the pack and immediately opened it. There was little in it save the books and Molly's candles. I had stowed most of my clothing, the Elderling firebrick, and other possessions in the tidy cabin cupboards. In the bottom, one of my shirts wrapped the tubes of dragon silver. I had judged my pack to be the most private place to keep such things. They were wrapped as I had left them. He had spoken true. He hadn't rummaged. A waft of fragrance rose to me. I breathed in Molly's perfumes from the candles. With them came calm. Clarity. I lifted the books out to shift the candles to a safer position. His words were hesitant.
I'm sorry if I've hurt you. Please, don't blame Spark or Perseverance. It was a chance remark on his part, and the girl acted under duress.
Molly's calmness, Molly's stubborn sense of fairness. Why was it so hard? Was there anything in those books that he did not already know about me? What could I lose? Was not all lost to me already? Did he not share that loss? Snow had dampened one corner of Bee's dream journal. It had dried, but the leather cover had puckered slightly, rippling the embossing. I tried to smooth it with my thumb. It resisted. I opened it slowly. I cleared my throat. On the first page, I said, and my voice squeaked tight. The fool looked blindly toward me, tears streaming down his cheeks. I cleared my throat again. On the first page, there is a drawing of a bee. It is exactly the size of a bee and exactly the colours of a bee. Above the bee, written very carefully in a sort of arc, are the words, "This is my dream journal of my important dreams." His breath caught in his throat. He sat very still. I stood up, crossing that tiny room, took less than 3 steps. Something, not pride, not selfishness, something I had no name for, made those 3 steps the steepest climb I'd ever attempted. I sat down beside him with the book open on my lap. He was not breathing. I reached across and lifted his bare hand by its woolen sleeve. I brought it over to the page and lightly skimmed the arch of letters with his drooping fingers. "Those are the words." I lifted again and maneuvered his forefinger onto the bee. "And here is the bee she painted." He smiled. He lifted his wrist to dash the tears from his face.
"I can feel the ink she put on the page."
Together, we read our daughter's book. It was still a barbed thought for me to name her so, but I forced myself to it. We did not read it swiftly. That was his decision, not mine. And to my surprise, he did not ask that I read her journal. It was her dreams he wanted to hear. It became our ritual as we parted each evening. A few dreams from her book read aloud. I read no more than 3 or 4 every night. Often I read each one over as many as 12 times. I watched his lips move silently as he committed them to memory. He smiled when I read a favorite dream of wolves running. A dream of candles made him abruptly sit up straight and then fall into a long and pensive silence. Her dream of being a nut puzzled him as much as it did me. He wept the evening I read her dream of the butterfly man.
"Oh, Fitz, she had it. She had the gift, and they destroyed it."
"As we shall destroy them," I promised him.
"Fitz,"
his voice halted me at the door,
"are we sure she is destroyed? You were delayed in the Skill Pillars when you travelled from Aslevyol, but eventually you emerged at Buckkeep."
"Give up that hope. I was a trained skill user. I emerged. B went in untrained, with no experienced guide, part of a chain of untrained folk. So we know from Shun. There was no sign of them when Nettle's coterie went after her, no trace of them when we followed that same route, months later. She is gone, fool, tattered away to nothing." I wished he had not made me speak the words aloud. "All that is left for us is vengeance." I did not sleep well on Tarman. It was in some ways like sleeping on the back of an immense animal and always being aware of him with my wit sense. Often I had slept with the wolf's back against my belly, but Night Eyes had been a comfort, for he shared his wild awareness of our surroundings with my duller human senses. I had always slept better when he was near me. Not so with Tarman. He was a creature apart from me. It was like trying to sleep with someone staring at me. I sensed no malevolence, but the constant awareness made me jittery. So it was that I was sometimes awake and restless in the middle of the night, or in the dark grey time that comes before dawn. Dawn was a strange thing on the rain-wild river. During the day, we travelled down a stripe of daylight in the centre of the river, while the looming trees to either side blocked both sunrise and sunset. But my body knew when it was dawn, and often I would wake in the pre-dawn and go out onto the still, damp deck to stand in the unsilence of the slowly waking forest that surrounded us. I found a small measure of peace in those hours, when I was as close to alone as one can be on a ship. There was always a hand on anchor watch, but for the most part, they respected my stillness. One such pre-dawn time, I was standing on the port side, looking back at the way we had come. I held a cup of steaming tea in my 2 hands, a welcome warmth. I blew on it softly and watched the shifting plumes of steam. I was about to take a sip when I became aware of a light footfall on the deck behind me. "Morning," I said quietly to Spark as she came up beside me. I had not turned my head to look at her, but if she was surprised at my awareness of her, she didn't show it. She came to stand beside me, resting her hands on the railing. "I can't say I'm sorry," she said. "I'd be lying." I took a sip of the tea. "Thank you for not lying to me," I said, and I meant it. Shade had always stressed that lying was an essential skill for any spy, and had required me to practice artificial sincerity. "Are you angry with me?" she asked. "Not at all," I lied. "I expect you to be loyal to your mistress. I'd mistrust you if you weren't." "But don't you think I should be more loyal to you than to Lady Amber? I've known you longer. Shade trained me, and told me to listen to you." "When he had to abandon you, you chose a new mentor. Be loyal to Lady Amber." I gave her a piece of truth. "It comforts me that she has someone as competent as you watching over her at all times." She was nodding and looking at her hands. Good hands. The clever hands of a spy or an assassin. I ventured a question. "How did you know about the books?" "From Perseverance. Not that he thought he was betraying a secret. It was when you said we should all be learning. Per and I were talking later, and he said he did not like the sitting still and staring at paper part of learning to read. But he said that you had a book that Bea had written. She had taught him some of his letters, and he had recognized the book was hers by the way the letters were made. He mentioned it to me since he hoped that if he learned to read, he could someday read what his friend had written." I nodded. I had never said to the boy that the books were private. He'd rescued one of them when the bear had wrecked our camp. He'd even commented on them. I could not blame him for telling Spark. But I found I could still blame her for locating the books in my pack and then taking it to Amber. Had she handled Molly's candles? Did she know of the tubes of silver in my socks? I did not say anything, but I think she still felt the rebuke. "She told me where to look and asked me to fetch it. What was I to do?" "What you did," I said shortly. I wondered why she had sought me out and begun this conversation. I had not rebuked her, nor treated her any differently since she had given my books to the fool. The silence grew long. I cooled the heat of the anger I felt, and suddenly it became cold, wet embers, drenched by my discouragement with our quest. What did it matter? Sooner or later the fool would have found a way to get at the books. And now that he had, it felt right that he know what was in Bea's dream book. There was no logic to me feeling angry or injured that Spark had facilitated it. But still. She cleared her throat and said, "Shade taught me about secrets, how powerful they are, and how once more than one person knows the secret, it can become a danger rather than a source of power." She paused, then added, "I know how to respect secrets that are not mine. I want you to know that. I know how to keep to myself secrets that do not need to be revealed." I gave her a sharp look. The fool had secrets. I knew some of them. Was she offering me some of the fool's secrets as a peace offering for her theft of Bea's books? It offended me that she thought I could be bribed with my friend's secrets. Chances were that I already knew them, but even if they were ones I did not know, I had no desire to gain them through her betrayal. I frowned at her and looked away. She was quiet for a time. Then she spoke in a carefully measured way, her voice resigned. "I want you to know that I feel a loyalty to you as well. Not as great a connection as I feel to Lady Amber, but I know that you protected me as best you could when Lord Shade began to fade. I know that you put me with Lady Amber as much for my sake as for hers. I have a debt to you." I nodded slowly but said aloud, "The best way you can repay me is to serve Lady Amber well." She stood silently beside me as if she was waiting for me to say something more. When I didn't, she added with a small sigh, "Silence keeps a secret. I understand." I continued to stare out over the water. This time, she ghosted away from me so softly that only my wit told me when I was alone again. On a clear, calm afternoon, we came upon a rain-wild settlement. The banks of the river had not grown any more welcoming. the trees of the forest came right to the edge of the water, or perhaps it would be more correct to say that the swollen river had invaded the skirts of the forest. The trees that overhung the water were fresh with gleaming new leaves. Brightly plumaged birds were shrieking and battling over nesting sites, and that was what drew my eyes upward. I stared at the largest nest I'd ever seen, and then saw a child emerge from it and walk briskly along the limb back toward the trunk. I was gaping, soundless for fear that any shout I raised might cause the child to fall. Big Ida saw the direction of my gaze and lifted a hand in greeting. A man emerged from what I now saw was a tiny hut hung in a tree and waved before following the child. "Is it a hunter's shelter?" I asked him, and he stared at me as if my words made no sense. Belin was passing by on the deck.
"No, it's a home. Rainwild folk have to build in the trees. No dry land. They build small and light. Sometimes five or six little rooms hung in the same tree. Safer than one big one."
She paced by me, intent on some nautical task, and left me gaping at the village that festooned the trees. I stayed on the deck until early evening, teaching my eyes to find the small clusters of hanging chambers. As the sky darkened, lights began to gleam from some of them, illuminating the flimsy walls so that they glowed like distant lanterns in the treetops. That night, we moored alongside several smaller boats, and folk came down from the trees to ask for gossip and offer small trades. Coffee and sugar were the most sought-after items, and these they traded in small quantities for freshly harvested tree greens that made a refreshing tea and strings of bright snail shells. Belin made a gift of a shell necklace to Spark, and she expressed such delight over it that the woman actually smiled.
"We're close to Treehog,"
Leftrin told us at the galley table that night.
"Probably past Kasserik tomorrow morning and be in Treehog in the afternoon."
"You won't stop in Kasserik?"
Perseverance asked curiously.
"I thought that's where the dragons hatched."
"It was,"
Leftrin scowled, and then said,
"and it's the home of traitors, folk who betrayed the trade away and never suffered any consequences for it. People who harbored those who would have slaughtered dragons for their blood and bones and scales. We gave them a chance to redeem themselves and bring justice down on the betrayers. They didn't take it. No dragon trader vessel will ever stop there to trade. Not until Kandril and his cronies are brought to justice."
The color drained from Spark's face. I wondered how well she had hidden the tiny vial of dragon blood she had pilfered from Shade, or if the fool had used all of it. I had never heard Leftrin speak so vehemently. Yet Amber sounded calm and almost cheerful as she said,
"I shall be so pleased to see Althea and Brashen again. Or perhaps the word I must use now is meet. Would that I could see them again, and Boyo."
Captain Leftrin looked startled for a moment.
"I'd forgotten you knew them, but in any case, you would not see Boyo. Some years back he went off to serve a term or two on Vivacia, and never returned. Vivacia had a right to demand him, but I know it was a wrench for Althea and Brashen to let him go. But he's a man now, and he has the right to choose his own life. He may wear the Trell name, but from his mother's side, he's a Vestrit, and Vivacia has a right to him, and he to her, though the Pirate Isles may not agree with that."
He lowered his voice. Paragon was not pleased to see him go. He demanded that there be an exchange. He wanted to be given his namesake, Paragon Ludluck. He's a Ludluck by right, but I hear in the Pirate Isles they call him Kennetson. Leftrin scratched a whiskery cheek. "Well, Kennetson is the son of the Queen of the Pirate Isles, and she wasn't willing to let the lad go. Paragon said he'd been cheated. He called it as he saw it, an exchange of hostages, though he was quick to point out that he had a more rightful claim to both men. But Queen Etta of the Pirate Isles simply said no. We even heard a rumour that Kennetson was courting and was likely to wed a wealthy lady from the Spice Isles. Well, Queen Etta had best marry him off soon, if that's what she intends. He's well past the age for it, and if he does wed, then I doubt he will ever sail on Paragon's decks. Paragon becomes moody or disconsolate whenever it is spoken about,
so perhaps the fewer questions about Boyor, the better.
I don't understand, I objected softly, though obviously Amber did. Leftrin hesitated.
Ah, well.
He spoke slowly, as if revealing a confidence.
Althea and Brashen captained the Paragon now, but for generations he belonged to the Ludluk family. He was stolen, and for a time the pirate Igrot used him for foul ends. Scuttled and scarred, he somehow managed to find his way back to Abingtown beach. And then he was righted and hauled out to languish on shore for years. Brashen Trell and the Vestrit family claimed Paragon when he was a washed-up hulk. They refitted him and put him out to sea again. But he's a Ludluk ship at heart still, and for a time the pirate Kennet Ludluk reclaimed him and died on Paragon's deck. The ship would want Kennet's son, and Boyor.
And Althea?
Amber queried.
Had she anything to say about Kennet's son living aboard Paragon?
Leftrin looked at her. I sensed a tale untold, but he said only, Another discussion that were better not held on Paragon's deck. They no longer call him the Mad Ship, but I would not tempt his temper, or Althea's. They are bound to disagree on some things. Amber nodded gratefully.
I thank you for your warnings. A careless tongue can do much damage.
It was hard to sleep that night. A different ship and the next leg of our journey loomed before us. I'd be going deeper into territory unknown to me and taking people little more than children with me. I spoke into the darkness of our cabin. It's in my mind, Perseverance, to ask Captain Leftrin if he might not take you on as a ship's boy. You seem well suited to this trade. What think you of that? Silence followed my words, then his voice came out of the dark, tinged with alarm.
You mean afterward, when we are homeward bound again?
No, I mean tomorrow. His voice was lower when he said,
But I vowed my service to you, sir.
I could release you from that vow, help you set your feet on a brighter and cleaner way than the one I must follow. I heard him draw a long breath.
You could release me from your service, sir. Indeed, if you chose to turn me out, I could no longer claim to be yours. But only B could release me from the promise I made to avenge her. Turn me out if you wish, sir, but I will still have to follow this to the end.
I heard Lent turn over in his bunk. I had thought him asleep, and his voice was so thick that perhaps he had been. Don't even bring it up to me, he warned me. It's as the boy said. I gave a promise to my father, and you can't ask me to break it. We follow you, Fitz, to the end, no matter how bitter. I said nothing, but my mind went to work immediately. What would constitute the end for Lent? Could I convince him that he had done his duty and could honorably return to Buckkeep without me? I did not judge it safe to put Spark and Purr on a ship home without a protector. I could claim I'd had an urgent skill summons from Dutiful for Lent to return home to Shade. By the time he found out it was false, he'd be home. Yes. I pulled up my knees to fit better in the small bunk and closed my eyes. That part, at least, was settled. A small but convincing lie in Bingtown, and I could get at least him onto a ship home. Now I just had to find a way to pry Perseverance loose from me. And Spark. The next day went as Leftrin had predicted it would. The crew began to say their goodbyes to us at breakfast.
Oh, I shall so miss having you aboard,
Elise exclaimed to Amber. Belin had left shell earrings next to Spark's plate. The dour deckhand had grown fond of the girl. Purr made the rounds of the various crewmen, making his own farewells. We spent our last hours on the roof of the deckhouse, for the day was almost calm, not chill at all as long as one's coat was closed. The weather had broken, and there was a stripe of blue sky over the river. We passed the dragon's hatching beach, as Skelly pointed it out to us, and then the treetop city of Kasarik. We did not pause, nor did Leftrin return any of the greetings shouted down to us. In the stretch of river between Kasarik and Treehog,
the little hanging dwellings were as thick as apples on a tended tree, and I did not know how he could tell where one settlement ended and the next began. But at some point, the captain began to return the friendly waves of folk from their treetop homes. We began to see floating docks tied up to the tree trunks and small vessels moored to them. There were people out fishing, sitting straddled on the tree trunks that overhung the water, and letting their lines drop straight down into the river. Tarman swung wide of them to avoid the dangling lines. I was fascinated by the hanging walkways and the well-travelled branches that functioned as footpaths. Spark sat beside Amber and me, pointing up at the trees and exclaiming over how some children ran heedlessly along a branch she would have thought too narrow to traverse with care.
"Treehog docks are just around the next bend!"
Skelly shouted up at us as she passed by the deckhouse. Big Ida was guiding Tarman in closer to the thickly banked trees. The water ran quieter and shallower, and soon the crew unshipped their poles and began to slow Tarman and then to guide him. It struck me that something felt odd, as if more was at work than merely the crew with their poles. The ship seemed too responsive. When I commented on it, Spark said, "But Tarman is a live ship. That means he helps the crew get him to where they need to be."
"How?" I was intrigued. She grinned.
"Study his wake the next time we dock for the night." At my puzzled look, she added, "And think of a frog's legs kicking." We rounded the bend, and my first glimpse of Treehog put Tarman's legs out of my mind. It was the oldest of the rain-wild cities. The immense trees that overhung the wide grey river were festooned with bridges, walkways, and homes of all sizes. The swampy, flood-prone land beneath the branches of the ancient forest allowed no permanent dwellings. The city of Treehog was built almost entirely in the branches of the trees that lined the river. Dwellings as big as manor houses were built in the lower, thicker branches. They put me somewhat in mind of the houses of the Mountain Kingdom, where the trees were integral parts of the structures. But these were not as integrated into their jungle setting. I could as easily believe that some storm had blown a grand home from Farrow and deposited it here. They were built of all rich wood with glass windows and looked impossibly grand and massive. I was admiring one that seemed to have been built entirely around the trunk of one immense tree when Skelly said,
"That's the Cooper's home, Rain's family."
I stared up at the looming structure. Oh, wealth and importance personified. His family had been of the ruling class long before he became a king in Kelsingrar. Old wealth shown by the weathering of the ancient support timbers. I stored that bit of insight. So much useful information that I intended to relay to Buckkeep. When I reached Bingtown, I'd send several messenger birds to Dutiful. What I wished to share would not fit into one message capsule.
"Oh, look! Have you ever seen such a thing? He's magnificent!"
Perseverance's shout drew my eyes from the tree and down to the long dock ahead of us. A live ship was moored alongside it. Sails furled, he rode placidly at the moorage. The silvery wood of his hull proclaimed this was no ordinary ship. Unlike Tarman, this live ship had a fully carved figurehead. His dark head was bowed over his muscular chest, as if he were drowsing over his crossed arms. A strange posture for a figurehead. Then the hair on my scalp and arms prickled as he slowly lifted his head.
"He's looking at us!"
Spark exclaimed.
"Oh, Lady Amber, if only you could see this! It's truly alive! The figurehead has turned and is looking at us!"
I stared at the ship, my mouth hanging open. Spark and Perseverance looked from the ship to me. I was speechless, but Lant spoke the words aloud.
"Sweet Ida! Fitz!
He has your face! Right down to the break in your nose!"
Amber cleared her throat. She spoke breathlessly into our shocked silence.
"Fitz, please, I can explain everything."
Chapter 11. Passage. This is my most frightening dream. I dream it as a vine that splits into two branches. On one branch, there are four candles growing. One by one, they are kindled to flame, but their light does not illuminate. Instead, a crow says, "Here are four candles to light you to bed. Four candles lit means their child is dead. Four candles burn for the end of their ways. The wolf and the jester have wasted their days." Then, on the other branch of the vine, three candles are suddenly kindled. Their light is almost blinding, and the same crow says, "Three flames burn brighter than the sun. Their blaze engulfs an evil done. Their angry mourning purpose gives. They do not know their child still lives." Then the crow suddenly has a broken candle. She drops it, and I catch it. In a slow and frightening voice, she says, "Child, light the fire. Burn the future and the past. It's what you were born to do." I woke up shaking all over, and I got out of bed and ran to my parents' chamber. I wanted to sleep with them, but instead my mother brought me back to my bed and lay down beside me. She sang me a song until I could fall asleep again. I was very young when I dreamed this. I had only recently learned how to climb out of my bed, but I have never forgotten the dream or the crow's rhyme. I draw the candle as I held it, broken, and the pieces held together only by the wick in the middle. Dream Journal of B. Farseer. The very best part of our sea voyage was how sick Dwalia was. We had a tiny room for all four of us. There were two narrow bunks in it. Dwalia took one, and for days she stayed in it. Her vomit bucket and her sweaty bedding stank. In the windowless cabin, the smells in the still air were a soup that rose around us, thicker and deeper every day. The first 2 days of our journey, I was wretchedly seasick. Then Dwalia screeched at us that our noise and motion were making her worse and ordered us out. I tottered after Vindelire and Kerf. We passed through a dark space between the deck and the cargo hold, where oil lanterns swung gently from the beams. Bunks lined the curved walls, and in the center, hammocks hung, some full and some empty. It smelled of tar, lamp oil, sweat, and bad food. I trailed behind Kerf to a ladder and followed him up and out of a square hatch. Out in the air, with the wind blowing chill in my face, I immediately felt better. Once my stomach accepted that the world would surge and tilt around me, I felt fine. Dwalia knew I could not escape while the ship was at sea and was too ill to think beyond that. We had brought some food with us, but sometimes we would join the other travelers at the evening meal. There was a kitchen called a galley, and a room called a mess where the long table had a little fence around the edge to corral any sliding plates or mugs. The food was neither good nor bad, and after my privation, I was glad of anything to eat on a regular basis. I spoke little, obeyed the few commands Dwalia gave, and fiercely observed every detail of the ship and my two companions. I wished them to believe that I had given up defiance to lull their vigilance. I hoped to discover a way to escape at the next port. The breeze that filled our sails bore me ever farther from my home. Moment by moment, day by day, my former life receded from me. No one could rescue me. No one knew where I was. If I was to escape this fate, I would have to do it myself. I doubted I could win my way back to the Six Duchies, but I could hope for a free life for myself, even if it was in a strange port half a world away from my home. Dwalia ordered Vindelire to make us uninteresting to the crew and the other passengers, and he kept a loose spell around us. No one spoke to us or watched us as we wandered the ship. Most of the passengers were Chalcedian merchants, accompanying cargo to other destinations. A few were from Bingtown or the Rain Wilds, and some were from Jamalia. The wealthy stayed in cabins. The younger ones filled the canvas hammocks. There were slaves, too, some valuable. I saw a beautiful woman who strode with the pride of a stud horse, despite her slave collar and the pale tattoo beside her nose. I wondered if she had ever been free. I watched an elderly man with a bent back sold for a stack of gold coins. He was a scholar who could speak six languages and read and write in all of them. He sat stoically as a woman drove a hard bargain for him.
Then he bent to ink and paper to write out the bill of sale for himself, his nose very close to the paper. I wondered how much scribe work was left in his knobby fingers and what would become of him as he aged further. Time passes differently on a ship. Day and night, there were always sailors running from task to task. A bell ringing broke time into watches, and I could not seem to sleep through it. When it woke me at night on the splintery cabin floor, breathing the sour fog of Dwalia's sickness, I longed to escape onto the deck. But Kerf slept snoring across the narrow door. In the bunk above Dwalia's, Vindalaya muttered in his sleep. If I slept, I dreamed. Sometimes the dreams that boiled and seethed in me. When I woke from those, I traced an account of them onto the plank floor and tried desperately to set them out of my mind, for they were dark dreams of death and blood and smoke. Several nights into our voyage, as I lay on the floor surrounded by our sparse belongings, I heard Vindalaya moan a single word.
"Brother,"
he said and sighed, sinking deeper into his dreams. I ventured to let crumble the walls I held so firmly against him during the day and stilled my mind to sense his boundaries. It wasn't what I expected. Even in his sleep, he kept a leash on Kerf. The Chalcidian had become passive as a milk cow, an attitude much at odds with his warrior's harness and scars. He asked for the food he took, and the female passengers were safe from his stare, even the line of female slaves who were picketed on the deck once a day to take the air. Tonight, I could feel how Vindalaya draped him in boredom one step short of despair. All triumphant and pleasurable memories were hidden from him. He recalled only days of dull duty. Every day would be yet another one of following his commander's orders, and his commander was Dwalia. I tried to feel Vindalaya's control of me, but if he tried, it was too subtle for me to find. I had not expected to find a foggy veil draping Dwalia. Perhaps she had requested it of him. Did she wish to sleep? It was unlikely that she wished to feel so sick as to daily remain in her bed. She had betrayed how much she detested him. The day she flung insults at him, he had cowered before her disdain. Had that been the first time she had revealed her loathing of him? I explored what he suggested to her. She could trust Vindalaya to manage us. He had repented his brief rebellion. He was her servant, totally loyal to her. He could control Kerf and conceal me for as long as she needed to rest. I tiptoed around the edges of that fog of suggestion. How deep did his careful defiance of her go? Would she guess it when she recovered from her seasickness? If he allowed her to recover from being seasick, I considered that thought. Was he keeping her queasy? Dwalia ill in bed relieved us of her slaps, pinches, and kicks. Was he starting to turn against her? If he no longer served Dwalia, if he wanted his freedom, could I feed that? Could I win him to my side, to escape, to go home? The instant that seed came into my mind, I threw up my walls as stoutly as I could. He must not suspect what I knew, let alone what I hoped. How did I win his loyalty? What did he most desire?
"Brother,"
I breathed in little more than a whisper. The rhythm of his stentorian breathing faltered, hitched, and then went on. I challenged myself. Was it possible to make my situation worse?
"Brother, I cannot sleep."
His snoring stopped. After a long silence, he said in wonder,
"You called me brother."
"As you call me," I responded. What did it mean to him? I must be careful what I invoked.
"As I dreamed I would call you, and that you would call me in return."
His head shifted on the bundled clothing that served him for a pillow. Sadly, he added,
"But the rest of this has not matched my dream. My only dream."
"Your dream?"
"Yes,"
he admitted. With bashful pride, he added,
"No one else ever dreamed it. Only me."
"How could they? It was your dream."
"You are so ignorant of dreams. Many whites share the same dreams. If many whites have dreamed it, it is important to the path. If a dream comes only once,
It probably won't happen, unless a brave person works hard to make it happen, to find the other dreams that show the journey to it, as Dwalia did for me.
Dwalia shifted in her bunk, a terrifying sound. So stupid of me. Of course she would be wakeful. The old snake never truly slept. She had heard our whispered words and would thwart my plan before I even formed it. And then I felt it. Deep and blessed sleep rolled over me like the softest of blankets. Warm, but not stifling. Muscles eased. Headache gentled away, free of the cabin's foul stench. I almost sank into it, despite my walls. I wondered how strong it was for Dwalia, and if it drenched Kerf, too. Should I tell Vindelire that I knew what he was doing? Could I threaten to betray him to Dwalia if he did not help me?
You feel what I do, and you guard yourself from it.
Yes, I admitted, as denying it seemed useless. I waited for him to say more, but he didn't. He had seemed so fatuous to me, but now, in his silence, I wondered if he considered his strategy. What ploy did I have to get him to speak? Would you tell me of your dream? He rolled onto his side. I could tell from his voice that he faced me now. He sent his whisper across the small cabin.
Every morning, Samisal would call for paper and brush. He and I were twice brothers, our parents, sister and brother, and their parents also. So sometimes I pretended that I had dreamed, too, the same dream he had. But they always called me a liar. They knew. So Samisal had all the dreams, and I had only one. Even Odessa, my twin, born as badly made as I was, had dreams. But I had only one. Useless Vindelire.
Brother bred to sister? His parentage horrified me, but it had not been his doing. I held back my dismay to say only, "But you had one dream?"
I did. I dreamed I found you. On a day white with snow, I called you brother, and you came with me.
It came true, then?
Dreams don't come true, he corrected. If the dream is on the true path, we journey toward it. The four know the path. They find the correct dreams and send forth servants to make the path for the world to follow. Finding the dream moment is like finding a guidepost on the road. It confirms the path is true.
I see, I said, though I didn't. So your dream brought us together.
No,
he admitted sadly.
My dream was only a tiny dream, a little tiny part. Not very important, Dwalia says. I should not think I was important. Many people had better dreams than mine, and those who sought the dreams and put them in order, the collators, knew where we should go and what we should do to make the true path.
Did all the dreams say I was a boy? That question was simple curiosity on my part.
I don't know. Most called you a son, or didn't say what you were. In my dream, you were my brother.
I heard him scratch some part of himself.
So Dwalia is right. My dream was small and not very correct.
He sounded like a disappointed child, hoping someone would disagree with him. But you saw me, and you did call me brother. Did anyone else dream that part? I had never known that silence could be slow, but his was. Satisfaction and vindication vied in his voice as he said,
No, no one else dreamed it.
So perhaps you were the only one who could have found me, brother. No one else could have fulfilled that dream.
Yes.
He savored the word. This silence seemed a necessary pause in the world.
a time for Vindelire to possess something he had not realized belonged to him. I held it for as long as I could. Then I asked, "So for the dream to be true and confirm the path, it had to be you. But why did it have to be me?"
"Because you are the one, the unexpected son, the one in so many dreams."
"Are you sure?" Ellaria and Repin doubted it.
"You have to be. You must be."
He sounded more desperate than certain. He had called me the unexpected son when he first found me. I pried a bit more at that. "So in your dream, you were the one to find the unexpected son, and it was me."
"I dreamed..."
His words trailed away.
"I dreamed I found you. Dwalia needed to find the unexpected son."
He sounded both frightened and angry as he said,
"I wouldn't have found you if she hadn't been looking for him. She told me to look for him, and I found you, and I knew you from my dream. So you are the unexpected son."
He gave a sharp huff of annoyance that I had doubted him. He knew his logic was flawed. I could not see him in the darkness to read his face. I spoke gently to avoid angering him. "But how? How do you know that when I do not know it?"
"I know I dreamed you. I know I found you. There is not much white in me. Some mock me and say none at all. But if I was meant to do one thing as a white, I was meant to find you. And I did."
Satisfaction warmed those words. He yawned suddenly, and his voice went soft at the edges.
"When I am on the path, I can feel it. It's a nice feeling. Safe. You are not a true dreamer, so you would not know these things."
He sighed.
"It makes no sense to me. In all the dreams they quoted me, the unexpected son is the balancing point. Beyond him, all is orderly, or all is chaos. At some point, you set us all on a false course. But the divergence created by the unexpected son may be full of terrible destruction, or wondrous good. The course you create might lead toward a thousand possible futures that no one else could open."
His voice dwindled away. He sighed.
"I need to sleep now, brother. I cannot rest during the day. When Kerf is asleep is my only chance."
"Rest then,
brother."
I lay still, and for the rest of the night I slept little and plotted much. I stacked up my precious bits of knowledge. Vindelire had begun to deploy his powers against Dwalia. Controlling Kerf was wearying to him. He believed I was very important, and so, perhaps, did Dwalia. But did she still think that I was the unexpected son? With a few kind words, I had cheered Vindelire. Might more conversation recruit him to my side? I built a fragile hope. If Vindelire would aid me, we could flee Dwalia in the next port. Surely he could use his magic to smooth my journey home. I smiled, imagining riding up the carriageway to Withywoods. Perseverance would come to meet me. Perhaps my father, too, and Revel would open the door and come down the... But Revel was dead. The stables were burnt. Scribe Lant was dead. And maybe Purr, too. I wondered again if Shun had survived and reached home. She had proven herself far tougher than I had imagined her to be. If she had, would she have told them how they took me through a stone? And if she did, would they try to follow and find me? My heart knew a lurch of hope. My father knew how to travel through the stones. Surely he would come after me. I curled into a smaller huddle on the floor. A worry tugged at me. Could he guess that we had entered the stone again? The scent of my mother's candle tucked in the front of my shirt reached me. For a moment, it was comfort. Then it was alarm, followed by certainty. I'd found the candle because my father had brought it there. Shun had reached home, she told them where they had taken me, and he had followed. Followed and somehow passed me in the stone. He had dropped this candle, dropped it, and never picked it up again? I thought of the scatter of possessions I'd found, the tattered remnants of a tent. The bear's cat! Had he been attacked there? Had he died?
were his scattered bones sunken in the deep moss under the trees. I reached for Wolffather.
If my father was dead, would you know?
I felt no response. I huddled tight behind my walls. If my father was dead, then no one was coming to rescue me. Not ever. And my dreadful dreams of what I would become would come true. Unless I saved myself.
Chapter 12. The Liveship Paragon.
For generations, the secret of how liveships were created was known only to certain trader families. By the end of the war, with Chael said, and with the emergence of the dragon Tintaglia, parts of the secret could no longer be concealed. Over the last decade, the paradox of the living ship, loyal to the family that created it by destroying the creature it would have become, has become even clearer. The creation of the live ship begins with the dragon's cocoon, when Rainwilders first discovered immense logs of an unusual wood, they had no idea that they were dragon pods. The logs had been stored in a glass-roofed chamber in ruins that lay buried beneath the city of Treehog. The finders assumed they were especially treasured timbers of exotic wood. At the time, the Rainwilders desperately needed a material that would resist the acid floods of the Rainwild River. No matter how well-oiled and seasoned their hulls, traditional ships suffered gradual damage from the river water, and during times of white floods, when the river flowed particularly acidic, some boats simply dissolved, spilling cargo and passengers into the toxic water. The timber discovered in the buried Elderling cities proved to be exactly what they needed. Wizard wood, as they named it, was a fine-grained, dense timber and proved to be ideal for shipbuilding and resistant to the river's acid. Ships built from this substance were the only ones that could endure repeated journeys on the acid water of the Rainwild River. These highly desirable vessels became an essential link in the trade in Elderling artifacts, which could be ferried out of the ancient ruined cities in the Rainwild settlements. There they could be marketed at exorbitant prices to the world at large. It was several generations before the first figurehead on a live ship woke. Builders and owners were astonished. The Golden Dawn was the first figurehead to take on life. Conversation with the figurehead soon revealed that the ship had absorbed the memories of those who had lived aboard him, especially those of his captains, and an attachment to the family who owned him. The ship's knowledge extended to navigation, to the handling of weather and awareness of necessary maintenance. The value of such a ship became inestimable. Those who cut the timbers into lumber must have had early knowledge that these logs were not wood. In the heart of each log, they must have discovered a partially formed dragon. Even if they could not discern what it was, they undoubtedly knew it had contained a living creature at some time. That was the deepest secret of all, one the families kept concealed from all but Bloodkin. It is believed that prior to the emergence of the dragon Tintaglia from a wizard wood log, the live ships themselves were not cognizant of their relationship to dragons.
Of the Bingtown live ships, Trader Cauldra Redwind. I stood on Tarman's deck and stared up at Paragon's figurehead, my face, and an axe sheathed in the harness across his chest. Lant and Perseverance were transfixed. Spark whispered,
"He's looking at us."
He was indeed. The figurehead of the docked vessel looked as affronted as I felt. Paragon resembled me in almost every way.
"You can't possibly explain this."
"I can,"
Amber assured me.
"But not now, later, in private, I promise."
I made no answer. As the distance between the ships closed, Tarman's crew was busy with their poles, slowing and adroitly guiding him closer to the riverbank. Treehog was a busy trade center, and there was little open dock space. Ships followed the custom of mooring to one of the docked vessels and crossing a neighboring deck to reach the shore. I assumed we would do likewise. There was an open space near Paragon, but I judged it too tight a fit for Tarman. As we grew closer to Paragon,
He returned my gaze, scowling. Why does he have blue eyes? I wondered aloud. My own were dark. Amber had a strangely sentimental smile on her face. She held her clasped hands to her breast, like a grandmother looking on a beloved child, and spoke fondly.
Paragon chose them. Many of the Ludlucks, including Kennet, had blue eyes. The Ludlucks were originally his family. I carved his face, Fitz. Or rather, I recarved it. He had been blinded, his eyes chopped away with a hatchet. He'd been branded with the mark of his tormentor. Oh, it's a long and terrible story. When I carved his face, I carved him with his eyes closed, as he wished. For some time he refused to open them. When he did, they were blue.
Why my face? I demanded. We were nearing the dock.
Later, she quietly requested.
Her word was almost lost in the shouted orders as Tarman neared Paragon. Tarman's crew had sprung into action. My four companions and I stood on top of the deckhouse, out of the way, and watched. Our tillerman worked the oar to hold us against the current, as the others used poles to keep Tarman from meeting the dock too firmly. On two of the moored vessels, worried deckhands stood ready to stave us off, but Tarman nudged into place as precisely as a sword returning to a sheath. Skelly leapt from Tarman's deck to the dock, and in the next moment caught a flung line. She took a quick wrap around a cleat, then dashed down the dock to catch the next mooring line. Our squat river barge was a sharp contrast with the tall sailing ship. Tarman's shallow draft enabled him to travel up the river, where deep-keeled ships like Paragon could not go. Paragon was meant for deep water and tall waves. He dwarfed us. The figurehead that stared down at us was several times life-sized. His gaze shifted suddenly from me to the woman beside me, and his judgmental frown blossomed into a smile of incredulity.
Amber, is that you? Where have you been for the last 20-odd years?
He reached huge hands toward her, and if we had been any closer, I think he would have plucked her off Tarman's deck. She lifted her outstretched arms as if to offer an embrace.
Far and away, my friend, far and away. It is so good to hear your voice again.
But not to see me. Your eyes are blind. Who has done this to you?
Concern vied with anger.
Blind as you once were, it's a long tale, old friend, one I promise to tell you.
That you will. Who is this with you?
Was there an edge of accusation in his voice?
Friends of mine from Buck Duchy, of the six duchies. But let me save that telling for when I am on board. Shouting across a dock is no way to converse.
I agree!
This shouted comment came from a small, dark-haired woman leaning over Paragon's railing. Her teeth were white in a wind-weathered face.
Come aboard and welcome. Leftrin and Elise will send your things over, and then I hope they'll join us for a glass or two. Amber, well met. I could scarcely believe the news the bird brought. Come aboard.
She shifted her gaze to me, and her grin widened.
I look forward to meeting the man who shares a face with our ship.
With that, she ducked back out of sight. At her words, Paragon's smile dimmed, and he crossed his arms on his chest. He turned his head and watched Amber from the corner of his eyes. She gave me a half a smile.
That was Althea Vestrid, aunt to Queen Malta. She's either the captain or the mate on Paragon, depending on who you ask.
She turned her face toward me.
You will like her and Brashen Trell.
Docking and disembarking was a precise and slow process. Captain Leftrin had to be completely satisfied with the docking before he would allow a gangplank to be lowered. He ordered that our possessions be transferred to Paragon. Then he and Elise escorted my small party down the gangplank, across the dock, and then up a rope ladder flung down to us from Paragon's railing. Leftrin led the way, and Lant and then Perseverance followed easily enough. Spark's skirts gave her a bit of trouble as she ascended. I stood holding the ladder taut and waiting for Amber to ascend.
"No need,"
the figurehead announced. He twisted